through fertile valleys and green woodlands, past thriving towns and stout holdfasts and the castles of the river lords. Catelyn knew them all, the Blackwoods and the Brackens, ever enemies whose quarrels her father was obliged to settle. Lady Went, last of her line, who dwelt with her ghosts in the cavernous vaults of Harrenhal. Irascible Lord Frey, who had outlived seven wives and filled his twin castles with children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and bastards and grand-bastards as well. All of them were bannermen to the Tullys, their swords sworn to the service of Riverrun. Catelyn wondered if that would be enough, if it came to war. Her father was the staunchest man who had ever lived, and she had no doubt that he would call his banners. But would the banners come? The Darrys and Rygers and Mutons had sworn oaths to Riverrun as well, yet they had fought with Rhaegar Targaryen on the Trident, while Lord Frey had arrived with his levies well after the battle was over, leaving some doubt as to which army he had planned to join. Theirs, he had assured the victors solemnly in the aftermath, but ever after, her father had called him the late Lord Frey. It must not come to war, Catelyn thought fervently. They must not let it. Sir Roderick came for her just as the bell ceased its clangor. We'd best make haste, if we hope to eat tonight, my lady. It might be safer if we were not knight and lady until we passed the neck, she told him. Common travellers attract less notice. A father and daughter taken to the road on some family business, eh? As you say, my lady, Sir Roderick agreed. It was only when she had laughed that he realized what he'd done. The old curses die hard, my daughter. He tried to tug on his missing whiskers and sighed with exasperation. Catelyn took his arm. Come, father, she said. You'll find that Masha Heddle sets a good table, I think, but try not to praise her. You truly don't want to see her smile. The common room was long and draughty, with a row of huge wooden kegs at one end and a fireplace at the other. A serving boy ran back and forth with skewers of meat while Masha drew beer from the kegs, chewing her sour leaf all the while. The benches were crowded, townsfolk and farmers mingling freely with all manner of travellers. The crossroads made for odd companions. Dyers with black and purple hands shared a bench with rivermen reeking of fish. An ironsmith, thick with muscle, squeezed in between a wizened old septon. Hard-bitten sellswords and soft, plump merchants swapped news like boon companions. The company included more swords than Catelyn would have liked. Three by the fire wore the red stallion badge of the Brackens, and there was a large party in blue steel ringmail and capes of silvery grey. On their shoulder was another familiar sigil, the twin towers of House Frey. She studied their faces, but they were all too young to have known her. The senior among them would have been no older than Bran when she went north. Sir Roderick found them an entry place on the bench near the kitchen. Across the table, a handsome youth was fingering a wood harp. "Seven blessings to you, good folk," he said as they sat. An empty wine cup stood on the table before him. "And to you, singer," Catelyn returned. Sir Roderick called for bread and meat and beer, in a tone that meant now. The singer, a youth of some 18 years, eyed them boldly and asked where they were going, and from whence they had come, and what news they had, letting the questions fly as quick as arrows and never pausing for an answer. "We left King's Landing a fortnight ago," Catelyn replied, answering the safest of his questions. "Oh, that's where I'm bound," the youth said. As she had suspected, he was more interested in telling his own story than hearing theirs. Singers love nothing half so well as the sound of their own voices. "The hands tawny means rich lords with fat purses. The last time I came away with more silver than I could carry, or would have, if I hadn't lost it all betting on the King Slayer to win the day. The gods frown on the gambler, Sir Roderick said sternly. He was of the North and shared the Stark views on tournaments. They frowned on me for certain, the singer said. Your cruel gods and the Knight of Flowers all together did me in. No doubt there was a lesson for you, Sir Roderick said. It was. This time, my coin will champion Sir Loris. Sir Roderick tried to tug at whiskers that were not there, but before he could frame a rebuke, the serving boy came scurrying up. He laid trenchers of bread before them and filled them with chunks of browned meat off a skewer, dripping with hot juice. Another skewer held tiny onions, fire peppers, and fat mushrooms. Sir Roderick set to lustily as the lad ran back to fetch them beer. My name is Marillion, the singer said, plucking a string on his wood harp. Doubtless you've heard me play somewhere. His manner made Catelyn smile. Few wandering singers ever ventured as far north as Winterfell, but she knew his like from her girlhood in Riverrun. I fear not, she told him. He drew a plaintive chord from his wood harp. That is your loss, he said. Who was the finest singer you've ever heard?
Elia of Braavos, Sir Roderick answered at once.
Oh, much better than that old stick, Marillion said. If you have the silver for a song, I'll gladly show you.
I might have a copper or two, but I'd sooner toss it down a well than pay for your harling, Sir Roderick grasped.
His opinion of singers was well known. Music was a lovely thing for girls, but he could not comprehend why any healthy boy would fill his hand with a harp when he might have had a sword. Your grandfather has a sour nature, Marillion said to Catelyn. I meant to do you honour, an homage to your beauty. In truth, I was made to sing for kings and high lords.
Oh, I can see that, Catelyn said. Lord Tully is fond of song, I hear. No doubt you've been to River Run.
100 times, the singer said airily. They keep a chamber for me, and the young lord is like a brother.
Catelyn smiled, wondering what Edmure would think of that. Another singer had once bedded a girl her brother fancied, and he had hated the breed ever since. And Winterfell, she asked him, have you travelled north?
Why would I? Marillion asked. It's all blizzards and bearskins up there, and the Starks know no music but the howling of wolves.
Distantly she was aware of the door banging open at the far end of the room.
Innkeep, a servant's voice called out behind her. We have horses that want stabling, and my lord of Lannister requires a room and a hot bath.
Oh, gods, Sir Roderick said, before Catelyn reached out to silence him, her fingers tightening around his forearm.
Masha Heddle was bowing and smiling her hideous red smile.
I'm sorry, my lord, truly, we're full up every room.
There were four of them, Catelyn saw. An old man in the black of the night's watch, two servants, and him, standing there, small and bold as life.
My men will sleep in your stable, and as for myself, well, I do not require a large room, as you can plainly see.
He flashed a mocking grin. So long as the fire's warm and the straw reasonably free of fleas, I am a happy man.
Masha Heddle was beside herself. My lord, there's nothing. It's a tourney. There's no help for it.
Tyrion Lannister pulled a coin from his purse and flicked it up over his head, caught it, tossed it up again. Even across the room where Catelyn sat, the wink of gold was unmistakable. A free rider in a faded blue cloak lurched to his feet.
You're welcome to my room, my lord.
Now there's a clever man, Lannister said, as he sent the coin spinning across the room.
The free rider snatched it from the air.
And a nimble one to boot.
The dwarf turned back to Masha Heddle.
You will be able to manage food, I trust.
Anything you like, my lord, anything at all,
the innkeep promised.
And may he choke on it, Catelyn thought.
but it was Bran she saw, choking, drowning on his own blood. Lannister glanced at the nearest tables.
"My men will have whatever you're serving these people. Double portions, we've had a long, hard ride. I'll take a roast fowl, chicken, duck, pigeon, it makes no matter, and send up a flagon of your best wine. Yarin, will you sup with me?"
"Aye, my lord, I will," the Black Brother replied.
The dwarf had not so much as glanced toward the far end of the room, and Catelyn was thinking how grateful she was for the crowded benches between them, when suddenly Marillion bounded to his feet.
"My lord of Lannister," he called out, "I would be pleased to entertain you while you eat. Let me sing you the lay of your father's great victory at King's Landing."
"Nothing would be more likely to ruin my supper," the dwarf said dryly.
His mismatched eyes considered the singer briefly, started to move away, and found Catelyn. He looked at her for a moment, puzzled. She turned her face away, but too late. The dwarf was smiling.
"Lady Stark, oh, what an unexpected pleasure," he said. "I was sorry to miss you at Winterfell."
Marillion gaped at her, confusion giving way to chagrin, as Catelyn rose slowly to her feet. She heard Sir Roderick curse. If only the man had lingered at the wall, she thought, if only.
"Lady Stark?" Masha Heddle said thickly.
"I was still Catelyn Tully the last time I bedded here," she told the innkeeper. She could hear the muttering, feel the eyes upon her. Catelyn glanced around the room, at the faces of the knights and sworn swords, took a deep breath to slow the frantic beating of her heart. Did she dare take the risk? There was no time to think it through, only the moment and the sound of her own voice ringing in her ears. "You in the corner," she said to an older man she had not noticed until now. "Is that the black bat of Harrenhal I see embroidered on your surcoat, sir?" The man got to his feet. "It is, my lady. And his lady went a true and honest friend to my father, Lord Huster Tully of Riverrun?"
"She is," the man replied stoutly.
Sir Roderick rose quietly and loosened his sword in its scabbard. The dwarf was blinking at them, blank-faced, with puzzlement in his mismatched eyes. "The Red Stallion was ever a welcome sight at Riverrun," she said to the trio by the fire. "My father counts Jonas Bracken amongst his oldest and most loyal bannermen." The three men-at-arms exchanged uncertain looks. "Our lord is honored by his trust," one of them said hesitantly.
"I envy your father all these fine friends," Lannister quipped, "but I do not quite see the purpose of this, Lady Stark."
She ignored him, turning to the large party in blue and grey. They were the heart of the matter. There were more than 20 of them. "I know your sigil as well, the Twin Towers of Frey. How fares your good lord, sirs?" Their captain rose.
"Lord Walder is well, my lady. He promises to take a new wife on his 90th name day, and has asked your lord father to honour the wedding with his presence."
Tyrion Lannister sniggered. That was when Catelyn knew he was hers. "This man came as a guest into my house, and there conspired to murder my son, a boy of 7, she proclaimed to the room at large, pointing. Sir Roderick moved to her side, his sword in hand. "In the name of King Robert and the good lords you serve, I call upon you to seize him and help me return him to Winterfell to await the king's justice." She did not know what was the more satisfying, the sound of a dozen swords drawn as one, or the look on Tyrion Lannister's face. Sansa rode to the Hand's Tourney with Septa Mordaine and Jane Poole, in a litter with curtains of yellow silk, so fine she could see right through them. They turned the whole world gold. Beyond the city walls, 100 pavilions had been raised beside the river, and the common folk came out in the thousands to watch the games. The splendor of it all took Sansa's breath away. The shining armor, the great chargers, caparisoned in silver and gold, the shouts of the crowd, the banners snapping in the wind, and the knights themselves, the knights, most of all. "It is better than the songs," she whispered, when they found the places that her father had promised her, among the high lords and ladies. Sansa was dressed beautifully that day, in a green gown that brought out the auburn of her hair, and she knew they were looking at her and smiling. They watched the heroes of 100 songs ride forth, each more fabulous than the last. The 7 knights of the King's Guard took the field, all but Jaime Lannister, in scaled armor the color of milk, their cloaks as white as fresh-fallen snow. Sir Jaime wore the white cloak as well, but beneath it he was shining gold from head to foot, with a lion's head helm and a golden sword. Sir Gregor Clegane, the mountain that rides, thundered past them like an avalanche. Sansa remembered Lord Jon Royce, who had guested at Winterfell 2 years before. "His armor is bronze, thousands and thousands of years old, engraved with magic runes that ward him against harm," she whispered to Jane. Septa Mordain pointed out Lord Jason Mallister, in indigo chased with silver, the wings of an eagle on his helm. He had cut down 3 of Rhaegar's bannermen on the Trident. The girls giggled over the warrior priest, Thoris of Myr, with his flapping red robes and shaven head, until the scepter told them that he had once scaled the walls of Pike with a flaming sword in hand. Other riders, Sansa did not know, hedge knights from the Fingers and Highgarden and the Mountains of Dawn, unsung free riders and new-made squires, the younger sons of high lords and the heirs of lesser houses. Younger men, most had done no great deeds as yet, but Sansa and Jane agreed that one day the 7 kingdoms would resound to the sound of their names. Sir Balon Swan, Lord Bryce Caron of the Marches, Bronze Yon's heir, Sir Andar Royce, and his younger brother, Sir Robar. Their silver steel plate filigreed in bronze with the same ancient runes that warded their father. The twins, Sir Horace and Sir Hubba, whose shields displayed the grape cluster sigil of the Red Wines, burgundy on blue. Patrick Mallister, Lord Jason's son. 6 Freys of the Crossing. Sir Jared, Sir Hosteen, Sir Danwell, Sir Emmon, Sir Theo, Sir Perwin, sons and grandsons of old Lord Walder Frey, and his bastard son Martin Rivers as well. Jane Poole confessed herself frightened by the look of Jalabar Zo, an exiled prince from the Summer Isles who wore a cape of green and scarlet feathers over skin as dark as night. But when she saw young Lord Beric Dondarrion, with his hair like red gold and his black shield slashed by lightning, she pronounced herself willing to marry him on the instant. The Hound entered the list as well, and so too the King's brother, handsome Lord Renly of Storm's End. Jorri, Alan, and Harwin rode for Winterfell on the north. "Jorri looks a beggar amongst these others," Septa Mordain sniffed when he appeared. Sansa could only agree. Jorri's armor was blue-gray plate without device or ornament, and a thin gray cloak hung from his shoulders like a soiled rag. Yet he acquitted himself well, unhorsing Horace Redwine in his first joust, and one of the Freys in his second. In his third match he rode 3 passes at a free rider named Lothar Brun, whose armor was as drab as his own. Neither man lost his seat, but Brune's lance was steadier and his blows better placed, and the king gave him the victory. Alan and Harwin fared less well. Harwin was unhorsed in his first tilt by Sir Merrin of the King's Guard, while Alan fell to Sir Balon Swan. The jousting went on all day and into the dusk, the hooves of the great war horses pounding down the lists until the field was a ragged wasteland of torn earth.
A dozen times, Jane and Sansa cried out in unison as riders crashed together, lances exploding into splinters, while the common screamed for their favourites. Jane covered her eyes whenever a man fell, like a frightened little girl, but Sansa was made of sterner stuff. A great lady knew how to behave at tournaments. Even Septa Mordain noted her composure and nodded in approval. The Kingslayer rode brilliantly. He overthrew Sir Andar Royce and the marcher Lord Bryce Caron as easily as if he were riding at rings, and then took a hard-fought match from white-haired Barristan Selmy, who had won his first two tilts against men 30 and 40 years his junior. Sandor Clegane and his immense brother, Sir Gregor the Mountain, seemed unstoppable as well, riding down one foe after the next in ferocious style. The most terrifying moment of the day came during Sir Gregor's second joust, when his lance rode up and struck a young knight from the Vale under the gorget with such force that it drove through his throat, killing him instantly. The youth fell not 10 feet from where Sansa was seated. The point of Sir Gregor's lance had snapped off in his neck, and his life's blood flowed out in slow pulses, each weaker than the one before. His armour was shiny new. A bright streak of fire ran down his outstretched arm as the steel caught the light. Then the sun went behind a cloud, and it was gone. His cloak was blue, the colour of the sky, on a clear summer's day, trimmed with a border of crescent moons, but as his blood seeped into it, the cloth darkened, and the moons turned red, one by one. Jane Poole wept so hysterically that Septa Mordain finally took her off to regain her composure, but Sansa sat with her hands folded in her lap, watching with a strange fascination. She had never seen a man die before. She ought to be crying, too, she thought, but the tears would not come. Perhaps she had used up all her tears for Lady and Bran. It would be different if it had been Jory or Sir Roderick or father, she told herself. The young knight in the blue cloak was nothing to her, some stranger from the Vale of Arryn, whose name she had forgotten as soon as she heard it. And now, the world would forget his name, too, Sansa realized. There would be no song sung for him. That was sad. After they carried off the body, a boy with a spade ran onto the field and shoveled dirt over the spot where he had fallen to cover up the blood. Then the joust resumed. Sir Balon Swan also fell to Gregor, and Lord Renly to the Hound. Renly was on horse so violently that he seemed to fly backward off his charger, legs in the air. His head hit the ground with an audible crack that made the crowd gasp, but it was just the golden antler on his helm. One of the tines had snapped off beneath him. When Lord Renly climbed to his feet, the commons cheered wildly, for King Robert's handsome young brother was a great favourite. He handed the broken tine to his conqueror with a gracious bow. The hound snorted and tossed the broken antler into the crowd, where the commons began to punch and claw over the little bit of gold, until Lord Renly walked out among them and restored the peace. By then, Septa Mordain had returned alone. Jane had been feeling ill, she explained. She had helped her back to the castle. Sansa had almost forgotten about Jane. Later, a hedge knight in a checkered cloak disgraced himself by killing Beric Dondarrion's horse and was declared forfeit. Lord Beric shifted his saddle to a new mount, only to be knocked right off by Thoros of Myr. Sir Aaron Santigar and Lothar Brun tilted thrice without result. Sir Aaron fell afterwards to Lord Jason Malister, and Brun to Jan Royce's younger son, Robar. In the end, it came down to four: the Hound and his monstrous brother, Gregor, Jaime Lannister, the Kingslayer, and Sir Loras Tyrell, the youth they called the Knight of Flowers. Sir Loras was the younger son of Mace Tyrell, the Lord of Highgarden and Warden of the South. At 16, he was the youngest rider on the field, yet he had unhorsed 3 knights of the King's Guard that morning in his first 3 jousts. Sansa had never seen anyone so beautiful. His plate was intricately fashioned and enameled as a bouquet of 1,000 different flowers, and his snow-white stallion was draped in a blanket of red and white roses. After each victory, Solaris would remove his helm and ride slowly round the fence, and finally pluck a single white rose from the blanket and toss it to some fair maiden in the crowd. His last match of the day was against the younger Royce. Sir Robar's ancestral runes proved small protection, as Solaris split his shield and drove him from his saddle to crash with an awful clangor in the dirt. Robar lay moaning as the victor made his circuit of the field. Finally, they called for a litter and carried him off to his tent, dazed and unmoving. Sansa never saw it. Her eyes were only for Sir Loras. When the white horse stopped in front of her, she thought her heart would burst. To the other maidens he had given white roses, but the one he plucked for her was red. "Sweet lady," he said, "no victory is half so beautiful as you." Sansa took the flower timidly,